Mr. Elward.
Thank you and good morning. Brad Elward on behalf of Dr. Chandra and Marilyn Reynolds. Your Honor, this is a case on appeal from the denial of the defendant's motion to dismiss on qualified immunity grounds. We're asking you to reverse the district court's order and to apply qualified immunity. The specific questions that we have here today are whether the doctrine of qualified immunity applies to contracted health care providers for the alleged substandard provision of medical services to an arrestee who is yet to undergo his Gerstein hearing.
So let me ask you, just jumping right to one of the major questions for me. The Sixth Circuit has decided a case called McCollum against Teep,
yes,
in which they have held that a physician employed by an independent nonprofit providing services as a prison psychiatrist was not entitled to assert qualified immunity. So are you asking us to create a conflict with the Sixth Circuit on that point?
Well, I think Your Honor will appreciate that the Sixth Circuit is not the Seventh Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit has looked at this issue differently. And if we look at
the views of our sister circuits, and we don't create conflicts lightly.
And this issue was sort of discussed in the Sherman case, which was decided by this court.
It's a simple question. Do you see any way to reconcile the position that you're taking with the position that the Sixth Circuit took in McCollum? If so, I'd like to hear it. If not, then I would understand you to be asking us to create a conflict with the Sixth Circuit.
I think that decision is wrong. And
so
I think
there's no way to distinguish it.
No, I don't think
there is.
They've come to a different conclusion. And I was starting to point out, when this court looked at Sherman back in the 90s, one of the things the court did is it looked at whether or not qualified immunity defense was available to a physician. And it noted that there was a split among the federal circuits. And this court went with the majority of the circuits. And at the time, the Sixth had their own perspective, which I believe was also that of the Ninth.
Of course, didn't that precede the Richardson versus McKnight case?
Absolutely. But my point in... Pardon me.
Critically, I said it preceded Richardson.
But my point in making that observation is that this court has had its own viewpoint, which corresponds with what the majority has viewed. The Sixth Circuit has had what I would say would be a minority interpretation. And after Filarski,
I'm not entitled to disagree with Richardson, the last I checked, anyway. I said we're not entitled to disagree with Richardson.
Well, I think the court's entitled to look at the Filarski case and how it treated Richardson and revisit that issue.
And it does not overrule Richardson.
No, it does not. I agree with that. But I think
it's to say that Filarski is a different situation.
I agree. I think Filarski limits Richardson. Now, my opponent didn't raise the applicability of this defense at the district court. That was something the district court brought up on their own.
But we have de novo review on questions like this.
Absolutely. A waiver is a limitation on the parties. I agree. Absolutely.
And, you know, I have a broad problem with your position. I have other minor problems, including how it can be reconciled with the Ortiz decision. But my broad problem is that you seem to be saying that medical providers have absolutely no duty to the people in a jail until a Gerstein hearing or something equivalent to it has taken place. They can pull off their fingernails. They can watch them die on the floor. They can do anything. And that seems to me quite in conflict with the general duty that state actors or private contractors, if we're going to assume for the sake of argument that these private contractors are encompassed, that's contrary to the duty that they have.
Well, I think
why would these people not have realized that a condition as obvious as diabetic ketoacidosis, which every, you know, medical school graduate should know something about, why wouldn't they have realized that when they're told they need to monitor this guy, that they monitor him?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that your summary of our position is accurate as far as what we're saying.
You're not arguing that you have zero duty toward these people from the time, toward Mr. Okoro in particular, from the time he shows up in the jail until a Gerstein hearing.
The duties that we had...
Isn't that enough to deny qualified immunity anyway and let the legal theory get sorted out as the case moves forward.
Because our obligations at this point, based on the law today, were under the Illinois medical malpractice law. And the obligations that the medical defendants had during that time frame, it's not like Mr. O'Coral had no remedies against the physicians for their care.
There's a federal constitutional level, too. There's medical malpractice for the post-Gerstein period, and there's medical malpractice even when somebody's in prison, and there's an Eighth Amendment claim. And it seems to me the fact that medical malpractice may carry through all three stages doesn't mean that there isn't a federal constitutional floor that exists from the minute the person is in state custody.
Well, in King, this court said that medical malpractice does not become a constitutional violation.
I agree with that. And that's why deliberate indifference under the 14th Amendment applies after arraignment, and that's why deliberate indifference applies at the Eighth Amendment stage. The Fourth Amendment, the continuing seizure, has focused on objective unreasonableness. And if what you're saying is that standard is too high, but you concede that you have to answer at least for deliberate indifference, that would be something I'd be interested in hearing. If you think that you don't even have to comply with deliberate indifference,
well, I would say this, based on the current law that we have on the books today. I mean, the qualified immunity analysis, as you know, is a two-part. Is there a constitutional right, and was that right clearly established at the time of alleged conduct here in 2008? And our position is, at the time of this conduct, there was no case, and the district court acknowledges this and counsel acknowledges this in their brief, there's no case that applies the Fourth Amendment to the provision of medical care in the context of that pre-Gerstein hearing scenario.
But Ortiz is looking at the same period of time, the same period of time that the acts in this case take, and it finds that the Fourth Amendment governs the period of confinement between arrest without a warrant and the probable cause determination, and it finds a case for denial of medical care. It's the same.
But the cases situation. The cases that are out there today that involve the Fourth Amendment in that small window, the pre-Gerstein window, are cases that involve claims against police officers, jail officials, or psychiatrists.
The cases have said that matters. I just want to nail down the one point, though. Do you concede that the minute he showed up in jail, at a minimum, the 14th Amendment applied to him?
Right now, there's no case that says that.
I'm asking you to... There's no case that says that?
Right now, there's no case that says that as to this scenario.
So in other words, it's you're in a constitution-free zone when you're in custody of the police in jail until the Gerstein hearing. That's your position.
He has a constitutional claim against the jail for the failure to provide his Gerstein hearing, and in fact, they have that
No, that's not what I'm saying.
About the medical treatment.
The medical treatment. The conditions of confinement, in your view, can be anything between the moment in which he's delivered to the jail and the Gerstein hearing. They could put him in a cell that's minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit. They could deny him essential medical treatment. They could give him food covered with cockroaches. They could do anything. And and the Constitution, in your view, has nothing to say about that period.
But I think you're confusing the concepts there from the standpoint of that we're not talking...
I want to get your position. So you think the Constitution has nothing to say about the conditions of confinement from the moment of delivery to the jail to the Gerstein hearing? Yes or no?
They do on the conditions of confinement respecting the jail.
Well, but that's under Estelle against Gamble, that includes medical care. I mean, that's included medical care for 40 years.
There's no case that says that the provision of medical services to a pre-Gerstein detainee is governed by the Fourth Amendment standards. And that's our point in raising the qualified immunity. If this court wants to say that, then you can. But in the context of this case, there's no case that predicts that we can reasonably draw that conclusion. And I would point to this. When the district court address this, the district court acknowledges that there's no case directly on point. If there was, counsel would have cited it, and we would have had a much harder argument.
But the law is clear that you don't need to have a case, quote, directly on point. If it's absolutely plain from two or three cases or from just the obviousness of the situation that there is a right, then that's enough.
You're right, but the right has to be in a specific. You cannot just look at the general proposition and infer the specific. That's what the case law says. The difference here is, and I distinguish this scenario with a medical malpractice defendant versus a jail prison guard, let's just say. The distinguishing factor is the presence of the medical malpractice action. What this does, if we adopt their position.
There's no rule under 1983 that says in some subset you are remitted to your, or at least not in the medical area, I should amend that, that you are remitted to whatever your state remedies are.
Well, you always have that remedy.
You are in state custody when you're delivered to the jail.
Right, but the custody.
In state custody, and then that custody gets tested by the Gerstein hearing or the equivalent thereof.
Just because a jail has obligations respecting custody does not mean the provision of medical care by a contracted medical provider. There are different issues.
That's the McCollum point, but I will just return to Stell against Gamble and say that one of the conditions of confinement when you are powerless to take care of your own medical care is the duty to provide medical care to you. The Supreme Court said that in 1975. So if you would like to save some rebuttal
time, I would like
time,
to save just a few minutes to respond to something. Thank you very much.
Mr. Ainsworth.
May it please the court, counsel. Philip Okoro suffered from type 1 diabetes, which is marked by the inability of the body to produce insulin. It's different from type 2 diabetes, which is an inability to produce enough insulin. When he was arrested and placed in jail on a minor property crime, he was totally at the mercy of the state to provide him with medical care for his obviously serious medical condition. Now, I'd like to, in our briefs, we raised 3 points, and we win on any one of those three, but I'd like to start by talking about the Filarski issue. And it's important to put it in context with what the Supreme Court has said. Every immunity that's been recognized by the Supreme Court has existed at common law when 1983 was enacted in 1871. And the reason for that, as explained in Wyatt, as explained back in Imbler in 1976, as explained in Tower in 84, and in Richardson in 97, and in Filarski in 2012, is because Section 1983 on its face contains no defenses, no immunities. But the Supreme Court, starting in 1951, began reading in immunities that existed at common law on the theory that Congress, if it did not want those immunities to be imputed into Section 1983, would have expressly disavowed them.
So do you agree with Mr. Elward that this case, this situation, is indistinguishable from McCollum?
I agree, and the McCollum decision is persuasive, because the McCollum decision looked to see whether there was, at common law, an immunity for medical providers to people in state custody, and found there to be no immunity at common law. And under
this Richardson concept of the market being able to handle the various incentives and disincentives,
which plays in here with the the medical defense here are employed by a multi-state corporation. It's one of the largest in the country, providing medical care in prisons all over the country, and they have the same exact market pressures as were present in the 1997 Richardson decision regarding the private jail, private prison. But you don't even get to the market forces and those arguments because there is no immunity at common law. And absent an immunity at common law, there's no statutory support for reading into an immunity into Section 1983. You cannot just create an immunity and foist it into Section 1983 jurisprudence without it having existed in 1871. The fact that the Filarski decision did not cite any case later than 1885 during its survey of what immunities existed in 1983 law is no accident. The Filarski decision was focused on what was present at common law. And then the point that Filarski was making is that we shouldn't be so focused on private versus public. What we should be looking at is, was there an immunity at common law? And here, it's the defendant's burden, because immunities are construed narrowly, They're in derogation of the search for truth. And what immunities they are, the defense have the burden to provide the court with some reason why they should be entitled to immunity, and they have not done that here.
So suppose, for the sake of argument, we think that that position is too extreme, and we move to this question of a period when the Fourth Amendment applies and a period when the 14th applies, and then, of course, ultimately down the line, the Eighth Amendment, kind of this three-part definition. It's clear why the doctors would prefer a 14th Amendment standard, to me anyway, because it's harder to prove deliberate indifference, I'm guessing, and the district court thought this as well, than it would be to prove objective unreasonableness. You don't have to worry about intent and, you know, the various things that are aspects of that. So I know that your original complaints did assert deliberate indifference, and the district court told you don't do that. You're talking about a Fourth Amendment period of time. So if you could talk a little bit about what the clearly established Fourth Amendment standards are, that would be helpful.
Since 1992, in this court's Villanova decision, it has been clear that the Fourth Amendment governs the time from the seizure at the time of arrest until the Gerstein hearing is held. After the time of the Gerstein hearing, then the 14th Amendment governs until time of conviction, where the 8th Amendment then governs the remaining period. If there is any ambiguity in that, how that was laid forth, this court's Lopez decision in 2006, applying the Fourth Amendment to the conditions of confinement, this court's Williams and Sides decisions in 2007, specifically applying the Fourth Amendment to the provision of medical care to pre-Gerstein arrestees, cleared it up. And then this court, Your Honor, Judge Wood pointed out in the Ortiz decision, held that in 2004 it was clearly established that the Fourth Amendment would apply to the provision of medical care to pre-Gerstein arrestees. So the only argument that the defendants are left with is their argument that we're different because we're doctors and not jail guards or law enforcement officers. But that's foreclosed by West v. Atkins. Under West, when you take on the responsibility to act as a member of the state to provide medical care, to care for somebody in state custody, you have to comply with the Constitution. And it doesn't matter if you're a doctor, doesn't matter if you're a jail guard.
So why does it matter to the medical care providers whether the plaintiff has had the Gerstein hearing?
It matters because that's what the Constitution requires. And it's simply
that's not something they consider in evaluating the medical issues. It's just another stage along the way as far as the medical providers are concerned.
Well, we don't know that, but what we do know is, you know, I don't know if they do consider the person's status in rendering their decision.
They give the same treatment, whether the
person's... I would hope.
Had a probable cause hearing or been tried or what have you.
I would hope, but they have
the
to. But they would have to comply with the Constitution, and the Constitution says that if you have not yet had a Gerstein hearing, your seizure is governed by the Fourth Amendment, and that's a bright line rule. And there is no case that has ever held that because you are serving a different role, you are operating under a different amendment to the Constitution.
Yes, if I were a physician, I would take post-Gerstein cases, but not pre-Gerstein cases. I'd be a little nervous about that.
Well, this is where the market forces, you know, do come into play. You, as a multi-state corporation, take into account the fact that if you're serving a jail that has pre-Gerstein people and post-Gerstein people, that you
because you have to know the difference, because you have to treat one with better than deliberate indifference. The others you have to treat with objective reasonableness.
That's correct, although we would hope that everyone would be getting the medical care that they needed. But it's all subject to the penological concerns.
I mean, you would have, in theory at least, although we've had trouble finding a practical difference, the same problem if in cell number one you had an inmate who had not yet gone to trial, thus under the 14th Amendment, and in cell number two you had an inmate who had been sentenced and was awaiting transfer to the state penitentiary, in other words, somebody now under the Eighth Amendment, and it does happen that the jails hang on to people for some period of time occasionally before they're transferred to prison. So you would have the different theoretical status anyway, even without this Fourth Amendment overlay.
That's very true. And that's how jails are set up, and they operate currently without day problem. And I would also point out, you know, that
because both are treated, because courts review the treatment by the deliberate indifference standard, right? So it's of no consequence.
Well, it's true that the Supreme Court has not yet decided whether there's or how much more process you're due as a 14th Amendment detainee as opposed to an 8th Amendment prisoner. There's been some suggestion that you're entitled to some better care under the 14th Amendment, but it is true that most courts will equate the two, the 14th Amendment and the 8th Amendment standards. But there...
Yeah, I guess what troubles me is the situation posed here would be that prisoner shows up at the doctor's office or the emergency care room, and the first call the doctor has to make is, has this guy had his probable cause hearing? Because that will we may run more tests if he hasn't.
But we do the same thing with jail guards. You know, jail guards would have to have let's take a police station lockup. You've got somebody in on a warrant, okay, who's a 14th Amendment person because they've had a due process situation. They're treated under one circumstance. You've got somebody else who's an arrestee without pre-Gerstein. They're Fourth Amendment. They're in jail cells adjoining each other, and they both need to be provided with medical care. One will be judged on the Fourth Amendment. One will be judged on the 14th Amendment. And this happens every day in every police station across the
So are circuit. You suggesting that in looking at the medical care under the Fourth Amendment that the deliberate indifference standard should be used there as well?
I'm saying that for medical care, for a pre-Gerstein person, that person should be judged on the Fourth Amendment. And this court is bound by its prior precedent
Until Judge Reagan's announcement of the application of the Fourth Amendment, you were perfectly happy to proceed with deliberate indifference as the standard of evaluation, right?
We did raise the issue in response to summary judgment. So
you still, and if I'm remembering correctly, even in your brief in this court, have indicated as a backup position that at a minimum there should be no dismissal on qualified immunity grounds because of the deliberate indifference point.
That's correct. If the court were to agree with the defense, we would still get a trial just under the 14th Amendment. But I also point out that the defendants, in their brief, in their opening brief on page 15 and their reply brief on page 15, acknowledge that the Fourth Amendment governs pre-Gerstein detainees. They're just saying, even though the Fourth Amendment applies, don't apply it to us. And there's been no case ever that has held that a state actor would get a different constitutional amendment simply because of the role that they're playing.
Doctor versus guard, yeah.
If there are no further questions, I'll cede my time to the court.
Apparently not. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Elwood?
Thank you. I do have a quick comment. I think as we move across the spectrum of the level of treatment that's provided to the individual, regardless of what you want to characterize them at, and then the liability that's imposed on the doctor for the various types of care, I think we've got two things that we have to draw from that. First of all, is that the doctors, we're not advocating that a doctor looks at a patient and says, well, you're pre-Gerstein, I'm only going to do this type of treatment, and you're post-Gerstein, I'm going to treat you in a different way. I think the court understands that the law has to be that the person is entitled to adequate medical care. But the question I think we have to add on top of that is, what are the consequences to the doctor for his actions in those various spectrums? And what we're saying is, based on the status of the law today, not how you want to view and maybe look at the law for the future, but as for the law today, that individual comes into the jail, he's pre-Gerstein hearing, he's protected by the considerations of medical malpractice, battery, assault, all those types of theories. He's not remedy-free against the physician. It's not a custodial scenario. It's not a seizure scenario. It's provision of medical treatment. As he moves through that, then we add our constitutional dimensions, and the deliberate indifference standard comes into play after that Gerstein hearing. And I think that is what the law is today. And I think the reason that counsel is not standing up here saying the Smith versus Jones case, Your Honor, is a case that said a doctor under these circumstances is governed by this objectively reasonable standard is clear. There is not such a case. And that was my point earlier. There is no such case. So the question is, can we construct
what
that?
What we have instead is McCullough that says you don't have any qualified immunity at all.
I think that this court has in the past ruled differently than that court, and as said in Sherman, in the cases of...
After the Richardson case.
After Richardson, this court has not really had a great opportunity to address Filarski, although I will note in King it seems to suggest that Filarski will apply not only the 1983 but also the qualified immunity defenses as well. That's how I read the King case, and I think I would urge the court to do so here as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will take the case under